Okay, let's get started. Let's see, today is Thursday. Yeah, so today is the last lecture I will be trying to deliver. I have some material, but it's towards the end of the class. Next class on Tuesday will be a discussion class. I want you to ask me questions. And Thursday is the exam. Okay. So that's how we'll go. I don't think I'm going to get into something brand new like virtualization. Maybe I'll mention it, but I just want to say a few more informative things about file systems and slowly wrap this thing up so that we're done. I noticed I am using the microphone because some of you like it. The battery is very low. There are no spares, so if it cuts out in the middle, it might do that. Okay, so what we talked about this is what the metadata of a file system consists of. There are inodes and there are directories. Directories are also files, but that's a special kind of a file. You're not allowed to read-write directories, but you can modify directories using certain system calls like unlink and create. Inodes have pointers to the data blocks of the file. Inodes are stored in the inode area. The directories are stored in the data area of the disk, but it's really metadata, and it contains the name of the file that it's supposed to contain and the I number of that file. And some of these files in the directories can be directories. And that's the simplistic design of a file system. Okay? We've covered that in some reasonable amount of detail. The file system is manipulated by applications programs. That's what you use to write files, read files, display files on the screen, whatever you want, interaction with files. And I talked about a few of these system calls. There's a lot more, but these are the important ones. You can create files, you can delete files, create and unlink. You can open files, you can read them, write them, you can also close them. That is, we're going to reuse the file descriptor. These are Linux system calls. Windows has the same thing. Its semantics are slightly different and the names are quite different. But functionally, every file system has to support this. Linux file system is a little different from the Unix file system. It's a much more evolved version, coming from the same base. The Windows file system is a completely different set of engineering designs where the metadata is in different places, unlike the Linux. It's not like one is better than the other. It's like done by different people. You have to store metadata. You have to design what metadata you want to store. You have to figure out where to store it. And if you start from a clean slate, you will come up with a design that's neither Windows, non-Linux. So there are many, many different ways of doing these things. But what exactly is done, the Unix system is kind of easy to explain. That's why I chose that. Now, with these system calls come semantics. No. This is a crude diagram, but what I'm trying to say is that for every per process basis, there's at least two things that are in every process, and it's private data. The file table, the open file table, this contains the I numbers of the files this process has opened. And the file table is organized as an array, and the file descriptors are 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, up to 16, I believe. So that's the file table that's private to this process. There's a file pointer per open file. That's the pointer which says how much of the file have you read or written. And that is on a per process basis. Because I'm mentioning that because the same file can be used by two processes concurrently, and they will have two separate file pointers because they're going at it slightly differently. And the same file may exist in multiple file tables, but the other files may not. And but this is per process. On a global basis, there is the files themselves on disk, that's system-wide, as well as there's these buffers. The buffers are invisible to the applications. When you write to a file, it actually gets written to a buffer. When you read from a file, pre-reads are done and thrown into a buffer, just to speed up the operations. That's what we talked about in class two, maybe. And these buffers and files are accessed by the file system. Now, since multiple processes are concurrently accessing the file system, sometimes the same file, sometimes different files, but they're all going through the same file buffers, there's a whole bunch of critical section possibilities here. So these have to be guarded with semaphores and critical sections, essentially, so that there is proper sequencing of shared data. So there's some shared data in the file system, especially the buffers. There is private data in the process per process area. Okay? So that brings us to what happens if files get concurrently accessed. And this part is different for Linux and Windows. I'll cover the Linux. So if two processes try to create the same file, what do you mean create the same file? If P1 and P2 both have access to a directory, they can both create a file called file1. So if they both try to create a file called file1, that's the same file. It goes by the name. If that happens concurrently, the file will be created by one of these processes and the other one will be told it's already there. So this part is atomic. The atomicity is enforced by critical sections in the file system. Deletion works the same way. Now, again, the file will get deleted by the first delete. That's not necessarily true. I want to expound on the delete business. When two processes delete a file, the easy answer is the first one to do it deletes the file. The second one gets a file doesn't exist error. However, often what really happens is let me see how can I explain this. If two processes has the same file open, whoever deletes it first will cause the file to disappear from the system. The name will be gone. However, the second process which has it open will still have access to this file. This file will exist. The file will not be visible to any other process, or even if you do a directory listing, the file is gone. The second process, however, is happily accessing the file. It kind of stays there as a file with no name. And the moment the second process closes the file or deletes the file, closes the file disappears. And all its data blocks are reclaimed. Okay? Does it matter? No, but that's the rules of how the file system works. If you do something like that, you will see these phenomena happening. So the file delete is slightly interesting. Since the directory is a linear table, to delete a file, we don't go and erase out the name of the file. We just put a deleted flag on there. So the name still exists, but an application program won't see it because the operating system is going to pretend there is no such file. And the I number is reclaimed, the inode is reclaimed, put into the free list. That I number is no longer valid. And the data blocks that were part of the file are somehow reclaimed and put into the free list. So the file doesn't exist. Again, you may know this already, that when you delete a file, the data blocks already contain data about the file. They are not scrubbed. It still remains there on the disk. If they get reused, they may get rewritten, but there is no guarantees of that. When a file directory entry gets a delete flag, it just means that this entry is not valid. However, if If you try to create a file, it might reuse that entry and overwrite it. Okay? So whenever you create a file, a directory entry is created by scanning the directory entries and locating the first deleted entry. And if there's no deleted entry, then you add another entry. And that's how it works. So let's say we are deleting a file, and the file has four data blocks, A, B, C, D. These data blocks have addresses. The addresses of these data blocks are in the inode. How do you get rid of these data blocks? You add it to the free list. What does it mean to add it to the free list? Well, it depends on how your free list is structured. Your free list could be a linked list, a file, or a bit vector. Let's just look at this. If it's a linked list, that means there is a free list, which is a queue, and I've got to take A, B, C, D and put it at the end of the queue by adjusting pointers and putting more pointers in here in the first few bytes of the file so that they get chained up. I can put it at the beginning of the free list, I can put it at the end of the free list. Obviously, beginning of the free list would be better. Okay? However, all this chaining up will require so many writes to these data blocks. That's not terribly efficient. Even though it's linear, it's still not efficient. So some people say, make it a file. Don't have a linked list. Instead of having a... we have so many files, there should be a special file which just keeps growing as more and more files get deleted. And if this doesn't contain anything, it contains deleted blocks. You can do it that way. But again, then if you do that, you'll have to add the addresses of these blocks to the inode structure of this deleted file or deleted block holder file, and it'll involve some disk writing. So often the choice is a bit vector. The bit vector is a special vector in memory . Bit vector has as many bits as there are blocks on the disk. So it's a static thing. One long vector of bits stored in memory. Well, that's not true, but let's go with stored in memory, where each bit defines whether that block number whether that block is being used or not. And that way, if I want to get more blocks to elongate files, or I need more blocks to write files into, I can go look through the bit vector and find a block with one in it, flip the bit, I can use that block. If I want to free blocks, I just go to those positions in the bit vector, change them to one, and the blocks automatically come into the free list. It's a much quicker way of doing things, but it does need some space. If you have a million blocks, you'll at least have a billion blocks, so you need a billion bits, you have to do the math of what's the size of the bit vector. Okay. So it's a static, each one bit per block. And so it depends on the number of blocks on the disk. And the larger the disk, the larger will be the bit vector. But it's the fastest thing. Now I said the bit vector is in memory. Is that possible? There's enough space in memory to have it. But there are pros and cons. Which way should we go, in memory or on disk? Where is the bit vector stored? Let's say I've given a choice. Why memory, why disk? Any ideas? No? I'm sure you have an opinion. Of course, one major thing is the memory will die if you switch off power or you shut down the system. Do you need the bit vector, free space bit vector, to survive power failures? Yes, because the bit vector is telling you which blocks of disk is used for files and which are not. You need fast access to this, so you want it in memory. You want this information to stick around across reboots or power failures, so you need it to be in disk. So what do? This is where the problem starts in maintaining consistency of file systems. Firstly, you do both. And this is memory, this is disk. And you occasionally, when you reboot, you just copy the bit vector to the memory. But after that, as you're running, you occasionally write this out. Your updates go here, not there. Why not update both places? You will be writing a lot of little bits here. This is a block-oriented device. You will be all over the head moving and writing blocks. Every time you delete a file, you have deleted 100 blocks, you will do 100 writes. That will slow you down. So you do it there, and maybe every so many seconds, you write the whole thing out one shot, which will gather up all the updates that have happened and push it to the drive. But you go like, wait, what if somebody flips the power switch? Then this one will disappear, and it contains new information, and that one contains old information. Can we reconcile this?
Change both at the same time?
If you change both at the same time, you're going to get poor performance. So you want to delay the updating of the bit vector on disk. And if you delay, and in one event of a delay, power goes down, you won't have time to flush it. This is one of many reasons they say don't switch it off. Lots of such things happen if you switch off a computer, because there's a lot of caching in memory going on. So hold the thought. We have a problem with power failure and bit vectors. Same. Thank you. So you're running an active file system. Files are getting updated. New blocks are being added to files. New files are being created. Where is all this data? Mostly it's in the buffer area of the memory because it's a lot faster. And you're occasionally flushing these buffers so that your disk stays consistent. You can flush it constantly, then the performance of the file system will be low. So to keep up performance, we're going to delay the writes. If you delay the writes, any power failure is going to corrupt your file system in many different ways. Free blocks are really being used. Used blocks are really marked free. Some blocks that have been written, a file has been written, but that has disappeared because it hasn't been flushed. So they happen. In order to minimize this, it takes a lot of black magic.
Yeah. Is that why the disks are called volatile memory? Because
disks are not volatile memory. Memory is volatile memory. Disks are non-volatile memory. Disks survive power failures. Memory doesn't.
Wait, what's wrong? Power failure? Wait, volatile memory?
Non-volatile.
Non-volatile.
Yeah.
So volatile memory is right.
It just evaporates. Okay. So the first, the most consistent ones are which write. Anything that an application writes goes straight to disk. That's too slow. We don't use that. Delayed writes is where you buffer the writes and you do it later. That can cause trouble. But we choose to do that, and then we want to avoid or minimize inconsistencies so that several methods, all kind of little complicated, people think this through and come up with an idea, they find bugs in it. But the basic idea is when you're writing things, flushing things, you have to figure out what's the best order. Do you write the bit vector first, or the updated buffers first, or the inodes first, or in which order should you do it? And different orders will give you different kind of inconsistencies when the power fails. And you've got to sit and think of, if the power fails at the beginning, what happens, middle, what happens, end, what happens, how much data have I lost, how much inconsistencies I have created. So a lot of effort goes into, even though you're told don't shut off power, that's not enforceable. Power does get shut off. And power failure is the same thing as an operating system crash. When an operating system crashes, it goes dead. It's not going to flush the buffers anymore. So they're both identical and both happen. So you've got to minimize damage caused by this. And a big thing is to recover. I'm using the word inconsistencies, that means that is the metadata. Metadata is saying these blocks are free. Actually, they're not. The metadata is saying these the file consists of three blocks. Actually, it's five. It hasn't been. It was updated in memory, but it didn't make it to disk. So this will happen. So both Linux and Windows have certain flags by which they trigger a check disk or a file system check operation. And this is an expensive operation on startup, slows down the startup a lot, where they check the consistency of the file system. And that itself is hard to explain. For example, every inode is pointing to a data block. Is that data block in the free list? An inode pointing to a data block is a used block. It shouldn't be in the free list. If it is, then we've got a bad pointer here. The free list is wrong. And if it's not in the free, then you do a complete check. You catalog every disk block that can be reached through the file system. You find every disk block that can be reached through the bit vector. Did you get every block? If there are some blocks that are neither in the free list nor in the inode pointers, then you've got orphans on your disk storage. And then you have to figure out, okay, so what do I do? Orphans are easy, you throw them into the free list. But something's in the free list and it's already being used, I think you delete it from the free list. So there are whole recovery, error correcting or patching procedures that can fix inconsistencies in the file system. These are not foolproof. They do sometimes mess up because it's not possible to recreate something whose state has been lost. So another technique is to keep enough state that is going out to the disk on a regular basis so that if there's a power failure causing inconsistencies, these guys can patch it up. So we want to minimize any kind of inconsistency in the database. Why are we so paranoid? A disk is your long-term storage. You cannot afford to have that corrupted. Okay? So a lot of effort goes in the file system to make sure disk files are consistent. Let's say we have a file and P1 and P2 are concurrently accessing that. I said accessing. I don't know whether they're reading that or writing that. Okay, let's say they're reading that. Is there anything to be concerned about? They will have separate file pointers. The file itself will be in two different locations in their open file tables. And they will be, P1 is reading, has read till here and is going to read this. P2 has read till here and is going to read this. And this is the end of the file. I don't see a problem. And this is how it works. You get free read access to the file. What if one or both are writing? And the file already exists, that much material. And P1... is writing new stuff here and P2 is writing new stuff here. Is that even possible? The answer to is that even possible is yes in Linux, no in Windows. Different design philosophies. So in Linux, it says they can do whatever. There is no locking. There is no concurrency maintenance. Anybody can do anything to the file. It's your problem. Okay? The operating system will not guarantee anything. It will guarantee that every read will return the most recent write. What the second statement means is that if P2 overwrites something and then P1 reads that thing, it'll get the new value, not the old value. It is possible to have non-coherent systems where you just get the old value. Okay? So when P2 is writing, that update is instantly visible to P1. How is that possible? P2 is writing into a buffer. It hasn't made it into the file. The file contains the old values. Can't P1 read it? They take good care to see if P1 reads it, it'll read it from the buffer, not from the file, which contains the most recent value. Okay? So that's what the operating system is in Linux guarantees. Windows will not let this happen, or I think the file is, the reader will get the old values or something, I don't remember. It's a more complex locking organization in Windows. Whereas this one is free for all access, you can read and write at the same time. It's highly unadvised to do that. If both processes start writing at the same position two different things, you will get a mixture of things written. One process is writing all zeros, one process is writing all ones. Depending upon who wrote last which section, you'll get scatterings of zeros and ones. So there is no reason to do that, so hence they go like, that's not our problem. That's application problem. Okay? But the file system maintains its own locking or critical sections for its operation. Files are not critical sections. There's no readers and writers algorithm in the Linux file system. Journaling file systems are kind of interesting. Linux supports journaling. What it says is that at certain points in time, a file is reconciled to what it should contain. Then as you use that file, you may make updates to that file. If you make updates to the file, the updates will be written out as a log. This is not the right way to show it. So this one happened first, this one happened second, but this one pertains to this block, this one pertains to that block. So it's not in block order, it's in any time sequence order, and this is a set of updates to blocks of that file. So we have the old file, we have the new updated material here. We can go backwards and forwards, we can change to this, we can change to that. Secondly, these logs are often not stored along with the file. The log is a global log. That is, here's the file. We will not change any files in here. We will keep on adding to one global log all the updates to all the files as one stream of things that has happened. So it's quicker, but reading files are slower. For every block that you read, you have to figure out whether it's an old block or it has been updated and read from the journal. Okay? Writing is faster, reading is slower. So some people don't like it, but then they say, like, look, files that are read-only or read-mainly, collapse the log for that file, you'll get back the speed. A file which has a lot of update traffic, we'll keep adding it to the journal and keep it faster. So these are schemes people come up with. And there is a complete extreme of the journaling file system, which I don't think is used. In the previous thing, I said I have an older version of the file and there are additions or changes to the file. This one says, why even have an older version? Just have nothing. There is no file. There is a log of all the updates being done to all the files, starting with an empty file. So you just go pick out the latest ones for that file, you've got the file. I don't know why it's that good, but people talk about log-structured file systems because it's kind of a strange idea. This is thinking outside the box. You don't need to store files, you just store a log of updates to files. Let's see, are we done? Oh, no, I want to do access control. Okay, access control is a slightly different topic. Any questions about this?
Instead of files are logged, how are the files stored then?
The files are stored as entries to the log. So when you write, let's say, block A, block B, block C, block D of a file, the system log will contain, you've written this material to file X, block A, and then very soon after you do that, somebody else does something, then you've written. So there's just a ledger of what changes were made. How do I explain this in real life? You can have people signing up for various events, and you have a page per event that you add people's names to. That would be a filing system. Or if you have one logbook where you write down so-and-so registered for event A, then so-and-so registered for event B, then so-and-so registered for event A, that's a log. And in that logbook, you can figure out who's registered for event A by scanning it. So you don't need page by page per event. Just different ways of doing things. And there is trade-offs on efficiency. Crash recovery is much better in log-structured file systems because there is no strange metadata, pointers, files. It's just a log. Okay, this is a slightly different topic, although it's related to files. So any questions about how file systems are done and how they work? So access control protection, well, low-level protection is something we covered long, long time ago. Anybody remember how processor protection is achieved? You're supposed to know this. CPU modes. And how is memory protection achieved? Close. The two schemes, one is base and bound, which is the old scheme, not used anymore. The other is page tables. Okay, we are not talking about this. We are talking about the high level protection or access control. Of who accesses what. So this protection has to be there. This one is, you will not violate your memory spaces. You will not change to privileged mode. You will stay in your playground and you're not leaking out. But the way to leak out of your playground is to get into the operating system using system calls and mess with files, which are hugely important resources. Any changes you make to files will remain there forever. So that's a more high-value target, and you're allowed to do that. So there needs to be some access control as to who is messing with what. And all systems will provide this. So now, when I say this, how do we define who and what? In basic operating systems, who are users and what is resources or files. Now, this model also, it's not cast in stone, it gets extended into various things. For example, there's only one, generally only one user on an Android cell phone, but it has these permissions. Is this application allowed to use the network? Is this application allowed to use the camera? Those are also access controls, where the who is applications and the what is not just files but various facilities provided on that phone. Whereas a traditional operating system, the who is based on user ID and the what is based on files. Okay? So since this is my asset, there's one owner per file. And the owner So Linux and Windows and Androids very different. I'm talking Linux. A human being gets on a computer. You're asked to sign on. You may disable the sign on, but you will then get to a default user profile. And then whenever you run applications, every process that's part of that application will be tagged with Alice. And there's a reason for that. So the applications run under owner's ID, and the owner is typically the avatar for the human. However, on an Android cell phone, I'm not so sure about iOS, every application has a user ID. Every application has a different user ID. So depending on which application you start up, it runs under that user ID, and then there is controls over which user ID can access what. On a computer, they're both operating systems, but they're designed differently. On a computer, Alice has access to a bunch of files which are owned by Alice or even not owned by Alice. Every application that Alice runs has access to all those files. And all applications have access to network, camera, speakers, microphones, everything. There is no segmented thing about this application can and that application cannot. Two models of operation. So when an application accesses the files have three sets of permissions. This is for Linux. Windows is a whole lot more complicated scheme. I get very muddled up with the Windows access control list because you can set things at a very fine granularity. This one allows only three. Somehow Windows made it much more fine-tunable. So this has three. The application has an ID. The file has an ID, which is the owner ID. If the application belongs to the owner, then these permissions apply. If the application belongs to not the owner of this file, then these permissions apply, the group, the other's permission. And there is some special users, which is pretty much null these days, who are not the owner but belong to something called the owner's group. Okay? So the group permissions are not that important anymore. It's the owners versus the others. So you can, if you have a file, you can give other people who are not you, this is getting to be diminishing returns, the ability to read or write or execute or all of the above to other folks. And it's checked, the permissions are checked. So everything, every file that you access, you have to open first. That's the point where it's checked. So simply put, the file has an owner ID, the application has a user ID. If both of those are the same, then the owner is accessing the file, and the owner bits apply. If they are not the same, one of the other two bits set of bits apply. There are three bits determining permissions. Okay? So this is pretty much a static scheme, except that the permissions of the files, the different permissions, can be changed by the owner only. Well, that's not true. In addition to that, there is this superpower called root. Okay? Sometimes they're called super users. Root in Linux, administrator in Windows. Just two words. These two are special accounts which has complete power over everything on that computer. And they can do anything. Now, how do you become one of these? By knowing the administrator or root password. You can take over the machine. If it's your own machine, it doesn't matter. You can destroy it if you want to. Okay? But in general, since they have these higher powers, we'll talk about what powers, you are strongly recommended not to elevate your power to that level, because a simple mistake can mess with your system, whereas if you don't have superpowers, a mistake will be caught. For example, so any function that the operating system supports is supported for the user root without checking. So let's say you want to delete a bunch of files. If you're not root and you start deleting system files, you'll run into permission problems. That those are not owned by you, you cannot delete them. So you're prevented from harming the system, the applications and the files that are stored there. But if you're root, it'll just delete first, ask questions later, so you're gone by then. So it's kind of dangerous. It can change permissions of anything. So you can change the permissions to, well, that's not, that can be more malicious than dangerous. But you can change passwords of anybody. So you wanted to change your own password, you were running as root, you mistyped your name to somebody else's and changed that password. Various bad things can happen, which is why. But often you need to be root in order to do certain tasks. For example, installing applications. I think it's SUID, I forget. There are system calls by which an application who's not root or not administrator under Windows can say, I want to be root. And it's called privilege escalation. So if you're running an installer that needs to install a bunch of files that doesn't belong to you because it belongs to the system, it's in that protected directory, it can't do it. It is going to request to the operating system, I have a task that needs the super user powers, I want the super user power. That's when this pop-up box appears. Are you okay with this? And it's kind of a kludge because you can always say okay and we don't know who you are, we're not going to check. Sometimes it's password protected. But that's called privilege escalation. It happens all the time on all systems. So only when you're doing, not all the time, only when you're doing system upgrades and things like that. And you can also purposely escalate if you want to kill some processes that are running under root privileges, etc. Then you can create a shell, you can manually switch to root, and then you can do that. Administrative tasks. So the privilege escalation sometimes is a mystery. It just means that you're forcing the system to treat you as the boss. But it's only done for short periods of time for certain applications, so it limits the harm that can be done. Okay, what else? Do we have any questions? I have plenty of time, but if I start something else, I don't have enough time for it. Yeah.
For the second final, are you going to be focusing more on the topics you didn't cover in the first?
Not necessarily. It is just a combined exam, scattering of topics from various places in both exams. Okay. I'll explain. A lot of you have questions about what is this part one, part two. It's essentially an administrative trick because the exam is supposed to be on Thursday. What date? May 3rd. And within about 2 or 3 days, the grades are due. That's not possible with a class of like 140 students. So we do a part of it ahead of time so that that part can be graded first. So it's just chopped into two. The exam's supposed to be something like 2 hours. So we'll do 1 hour, 15 minutes first shot, and maybe 1 hour plus some time I'll decide for the second shot. Yeah.
Is there going to be stuff on the first exam?
Stuff?
Like information like that we took on the first exam.
The questions will not repeat. It's two different exams.
Okay.
It's just one exam cut into two pieces.
Well, I meant like the first midterm.
Oh, first midterm. Generally not.
Okay.
Very rarely I have done that. And strangely, people don't seem to get it right, even though you know the answers to the midterm. Yeah.
Maybe not the question itself, but will the topics
from
the midterm one be on?
Yeah, if the midterm had concurrency, you can pretty much bet this will have concurrency. That's one major topic. But midterm didn't have anything on the later part, and some of those topics will show up somewhere. Yeah. Part one is on also a Thursday.
Next week,
Thursday, and part two is a week after that. Yeah.
Are there any topics that you think we should focus on a lot?
Pretty much the course. You're responsible for the course, which has some basic intro, protection, CPU scheduling. I'll go over the list. CPU scheduling. Concurrency, processors, threads, semaphores, monitors, and memory management, deadlocks, device management, file systems. I'm probably missing one topic.
Pages,
memory management. Anyway, I'll show you a list of topics. Yeah.
Will the exam be open notes?
Yeah. Yeah, same as last time. Yeah. Both parts. Okay, so come prepared with questions on Tuesday, and then we'll start the exams on Thursday.
Yeah.
It'll eventually get posted to the ASU grading.
Is there some way we can know our grades in this course?
Yeah, but there'll be some delays in that. It'll first be on the ASU site, and then, you know, my site has grades posted. It'll get filled.
Wait, where?
There is grades already posted.
Oh. On your site?
Or? Yeah.
Oh.
You've been there forever.
Escalation. So, there's an app that wants to work. Could the super user just choose to run as administrator or something?
Super user can what?
Run as administrator.
Administrator is super user.
So, user runs an app. What do you mean when an app wants to run as root?
Root, super user, administrator, same thing. App wants to run as root because it needs to do something that's protected.
So that's why it has this.
Yeah, that's when those things happen.
So the super user can change permissions of anything or anyone. Does that include guest users?
Anyone, anything.
I wouldn't have been as motivated if it wasn't going to class. Okay, I'll see you guys.